Welcome to Business Lives by Vox Markets, the podcast that brings you closer to the people who shape the world of business. We give you an insight into the lives of the individuals who stand out from the crowd. For updates on the latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel.
On the podcast today, we have world-renowned futurist and fintech expert Brett King. Brett is a best-selling author and leading thinker in the world of technology who has advised the Obama administration on fintech policy. Brett is also the co-founder and CEO of mobile banking startup Movum, which has raised over $44 million. He also hosts the world number one fintech radio show, Breaking Banks.
Banks would find it very, very difficult to move off their traditional distribution mechanisms with physical banking artifacts, and so technology companies would be better placed. And so his question was, who's going to do this? And, I saw a window of opportunity.
So, Brett, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. For some of our listeners who may not be familiar with your work, can you just give us a quick sort of summary of what you're about?
So I'm an author. I'm a futurist in the space. I write my last book, Augmented Life in the Smart Lane, was a book focused on sort of the next 20 to 30 years in terms of how technology is going to change the way we live and work. But most of my work's been done in the financial services space. So Bank 2.0, Branch Today, Gone Tomorrow, Bank 3.0, Bank 4.0 is coming out in the summer. And Breaking Banks is the radio show run out of New York on the AM band here. And we go out with a podcast to 140 countries on fintech disruption. And in my spare time, I'm the founder and chairman of a neo-challenger bank based out of New York called Movin, which we established back in 2011.
So you're really in that sort of fintech world then?
Absolutely, yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about Movin.
So we established Movin back in, sort of 2011. The idea came actually out of when I was doing my first book launch, Bank 2.0. I was out in California, and I was describing the future of the bank account, to this group of investors and thought leaders and so forth, at a networking event in L.A., where the book signing. And, one of the VCs there was sort of saying, so what's a bank account going to look like in 2025? And I was saying, well, you won't have any physical artifacts, you'll download it to your phone, you'll be able to tap your phone to pay or, just instantly transfer, and it's going to be a phone that can assist you, can coach you smart enough with some basic intelligence to assist you. And his observation, which sort of hit me, was, well, banks aren't going to willingly do this because, it's the sort of same scale of disruption that we saw with the recording industry when we shifted to digital and same with books and so forth, that banks would find it very, very difficult to move off their traditional distribution mechanisms with physical banking artifacts, and so technology companies would be better placed. And so his question was, who's going to do this? And, I saw a window of opportunity. So literally about an hour after that event, I had registered the domain for Movin Bank, Move and Bank, as sort of a mobile-focused fintech startup. One other challenger bank had emerged a few months before that, Bank Simple, or Simple as they know now, acquired by BBVA a couple of years ago. But at the time, there wasn't a lot of challenger bank activity, not like we had today. But the core intent of Movin was to create a smart bank account, so a downloadable bank account that could coach you, could modify your behavior so you can manage your money and be financially healthy.
Okay, that's very interesting. So are there any sort of fintech companies that really stand out for you, obviously apart from Movin?
Obviously, there's a few in terms of category creation here that have really redefined the way we think about certain aspects of financial services. You've got Zopa, which was the first P2P lending organization based out of the UK. Prosper and Lending Club, those guys as a class really changed the way the economics of lending Sort of transfer wise from, you know, from a transfer perspective. But today, when you look at, the fastest growing financial services organizations in the world, in terms of things like, you know, number of customers, deposits, the ability to scale, then, what you see happening out of China is incredible. 4,000 P2P companies there. You've got Lufax and others, but Ant Financial, is just dominating the scene there. Of course, Alipay and Tencent, WeChat, huge players in the mobile payments arena, which did $17 trillion in mobile payments last year in China. And when we look at that compared to the U.S. hopes to get to $300 billion in 2021. China really is at this point, I think, if you're looking for what the future of financial services is going to look like in 10 years' time, it's much more likely right now to come out of China than it is the UK or United States.
And why do you think that is? Do you think they're sort of more entrepreneurial, or are they sort of more open to these ideas?
So part of it is, lack of legacy. They don't have the same legacy architectures and the same legacy behaviors that we have in established markets. So in the U.S., if you want to get people to adopt, contactless mobile payments or QR code-based, peer-to-peer or something like that, what you have to do is you have to get them off checks. You have to disrupt that behavior. Whereas in China, you only had cash. You didn't have plastic cards. You didn't have checks. Those things were really not embedded there from a or statistically relevant from a payments perspective. And so when mobile came along, combined with network effect around social media, where these platforms emerged, Alibaba as a e-commerce platform and Tencent WeChat as a social media. A social network. These two elements combined to create a very rapid behavioral shift and network effect where people were sending money to each other. And they didn't have to get over that legacy. The other element of it is regulatory approach. So the UK has been quite aggressive in this over the last couple of years with a move to fintech. But in the US, they've been a lot more conservative, The UK has, 40-something challenger banks now in the UK, whereas the US has none, effectively, because you still need to go through the traditional charter process in the US to become a bank, and you must have branches, physical branches in the US. It's legislated, right? And so, if you're a digital pure play, you're just not interested in getting a charter so you could deploy branch networks. So, there's a lot of it from a regulatory perspective, where China made a pretty aggressive move early on to allow fintechs. They allowed digital onboarding and identity of customers, avoiding physical signatures. That was a massive shift in China. And as well as that, there was a lot of capital, available to deploy, into those markets as a result of sort of the growing middle class, growing welfare that was more distributed. So, a lot of different factors, but really, really interesting to see China sort of take some leadership in this respect.
Indeed, yeah. We've also seen, certainly in the UK, and it's pretty much the same in the US, a big change in the way capital is raised and capital structures and everything, and the advent of the ICOs. I mean, what's your thought on that?
If you look at what's been happening since the creation of the internet, what you can see is that we've created a real focus on lowering friction in engagement or experiences and digitization of value chains. So whether that is, onboarding a customer or selling through an e-commerce or mobile, app type architecture, or whether it is now looking at automation of the entire value chain, we're shifting to a situation where the most valuable companies in the world now on stock markets all tend to be technology-based. So we've shifted off, you know, traditional blue chip industrials, and we're moving now into the tech companies are where the growth is and the longer term opportunities are. So this is a structural shift in terms of stock market, where value increasingly is being captured by companies who can innovate around technology. But at the same time, you know, we see all of these industries, you know, financial services, you know, hospitality, you know, autonomous vehicles in the transportation arena, and you know, the gigging economy and so forth. All of this happening because of digital, but we expect capital markets to not change in this environment. I think part of this is the fact that you've got the commodities market probably, with energy being, you know, about half of the commodities market, likelihood is over the next 20 to 30 years that commodities market is not going to massively grow, and you're going to have low-digit returns, particularly on the energy sector, unless you're investing in renewables. Oil is going to be sustained low prices. So if you're looking for value creation at the capital market level, it's tied up with technology. And it also makes sense that these technology companies are going to use new technologies for, you know, raising equity or raising capital. And so along with the conversion to digital currencies that are more efficient on, you know, on the digital sphere, you know, digital capital raising is sort of a logical transition for capital markets to make as the world digitizes in general.
Mm-hmm. Are you a fan then of cryptocurrencies?
So I guess I am, in respect to the fact that I think if you step back from the debate around whether they're safe and, you know, the Silk Road and all of those sort of things, and this is where I think the futurist perspective helps, is as a futurist, what you tend to do is you look at historical analogies and you look at trends that are emerging and try to see how in the past, you know, behavior and adoption indicates how people are going to respond to something new, and how the economy is going to respond, and how you know, people's behavior is going to be modified. So when you look at money itself, and you understand why money was designed and why central banks issue physical currency, the primary demand for that, you know, that emerged in sort of the 16th and 17th century, was the ability to have common value exchange systems by geography. So that within the United Kingdom, the reason we issued, you know, the pound and we had paper notes was that, you know, everybody could then have a system of value exchange that everyone recognized, and there was a common a value system to tie that to. Now, if you look at, that's the purpose of money, to create that sort of common value exchange system. The reality is that physical currency is not well designed to fit in a digital world. And you can digitize it by creating an electronic version of you know, money, which we do today. But there is an argument that more efficient forms of value exchange might emerge on top of this layer that work better than you know, centrally issued you know, currencies based on a geography, because geography has really no meaning in an e-commerce world that's global and real time.
I think one of the fears for me would be that the governments could just sort of regulate cryptocurrency out of sort of existence. Do you believe that's the case?
Well, if you take something like Bitcoin, you know, you effectively would have to shut down the internet to stop Bitcoin from being used. Now, you could make it illegal to trade in Bitcoin, but you know, the nature of Bitcoin wallets and the way they work is it would be very, very difficult for governments, A, to track transactional behavior, and B, to stop you once you've done that. Of course, what we've seen in the US, where the IRS has moved to tax profits on crypto, is probably a better use of regulation in that they, you know, can then use, you know, the value created by crypto for revenue purposes. Ultimately, though, the real credibility will be when a central bank or a government decides to issue their own cryptocurrency. And we know China, the outgoing chair of the People's Bank in China, has said this is largely inevitable in China. And I think the reason being is that China sees cryptocurrencies as largely inevitable. So they want to be the first, you know, real central bank mechanism to launch a state-backed cryptocurrency that could become globally relevant. And they want to do that to reduce their, you know, reliance global markets have on USD. I don't think they've been able to do that with their physical currency, but with the crypto, I think they can see themselves making headway to erode the massive advantage US dollars have on a trade perspective.
Okay. So Brett, tell me now, if you were 25 again and you had $10,000 in your back pocket, what would you be doing?
Well, that's a good question. $10,000, what could you do with 10 grand? Probably, I wouldn't suggest getting into crypto mining, despite the conversation we just had. I probably would look at one of two things. One is, I definitely would look at, if you're more technically oriented, looking at artificial intelligence, machine learning, and, you know, pattern recognition. So, you know, get a computing rig with lots of GPU power that could enable you to do sort of AI type stuff that could be quite interesting, neural net processing, learn that sort of stuff. Or, go down the path of learning how to deliver, you know, great digital experiences on new technologies like voice or augmented reality. So, two huge opportunities in terms of the way we interact. One key, obviously artificial intelligence is going to underpin a whole lot we do. So, machine learning, neural nets, deep learning capabilities, learning as much as you can about that, and building some simple models on that front. You'll never, over the next 30 years, you'll never be short of work if you can build that basic AI skill. Secondly, in terms of interaction, what we saw happening initially with internet, and e-commerce, and then moving to mobile, with the creation of smartphones, we're going to see all that happen again with voice technology like Alexa, Siri, and so forth. And then the next phase of this will be augmented reality smart glasses that emerge over the next 7 to 10 years. So what I call the embedded experience layer. And companies that don't, just like today, the largest companies in the world are companies that were either created, on the e-commerce layer or created on the mobile layer. We're going to see the same thing happen with voice and with augmented reality, technologies. You're going to have similar booms, and a lot of existing traditional incumbents will need to transfer onto those platforms to be relevant. So they're two areas where I think if you invested a bit of money into learning and learning the basic skills around that, you'll never want for work or employment opportunities.
Okay, great. So you've got your new book coming out soon, Bank 4.0. Can you give us a quick rundown of what we can expect?
So the subtitle of Bank 4.0 is Banking Everywhere, Never at a Bank. What I did in the research around this was look at the modality shift that's occurred in other industries, and when we know your industry is about to be disrupted. So, like 10 signals that you get when an industry is about to be disrupted. And all of those signals are sort of screaming right now in terms of banking. And what you have is, if you look back in the mid-90s through today, you've had reduced net interest income, you've had reduced profitability in banks, reduced product margin, and increasingly the primary distribution mechanisms of banks, namely branches, are falling off a cliff in terms of their ability to generate engagement with customers and revenue, right? So when I look at this, from a potential perspective, then you say there's some real structural changes going on here. Who are going to be the organizations leading? So what I did is I looked at first principles design theory. You may be familiar with this. Your listeners may be familiar with this, where Elon Musk talks about first principles thinking in respect to Tesla and SpaceX. So, to sort of give you a quick illustration, SpaceX is now able to launch a Falcon Heavy at the cost of about $90 million per launch. The nearest competitor to that NASA's building, which the SpaceX rocket, the Falcon Heavy, carries about 63 tons into orbit. The Space Launch Systems NASA's building is going to be 70 tons, but it's going to cost $1 billion per launch, right? So 10 times the cost of the Falcon Heavy platform. The reason for that disparity is that rather than take the Apollo model and iterate on that and can constantly improve, what Musk did is he started from scratch. He used first principles thinking. He said, if we were to use the technology we had today, 3D printing, computer simulations, all of those things to design a rocket, would we design it the same way Wernher von Braun built the Apollo? And the answer was clearly no. And that's why they've got incredible economies, in terms of their rocket tech. Now, when you look for first principles, you do see it emerge. Throughout history, the launch of the automobile was first principles thinking about transport. The iPhone was first principles thinking about personal communication devices. When you look for evidence in first principles design in financial services, we can see it. The basic principle here is: if you were designing banking from scratch today, would you really build it so you have all these buildings where you have to go and sign a physical piece of paper to get a physical artifact as your bank account so you could transact on exclusively bank-owned networks and through bank machines? And the answer would be absolutely not. That's not how you design it. First of all, you would never require a wet signature because signature is not secure. It's not unique. It can be easily copied. So why we're still using signature to identify people in the system astounds me. You'd make it real time. You'd make it contextual. You'd make it highly agile and able to adapt. And so when you look for evidence of first principles thinking in financial services, we can see this. And when we see this happen in other industries, it really is a step change and a radical disruption of the sector that's coming. So I don't think banks really realize how disruptive this next generation of financial services is going to be. But I think probably half of the banks that we know today probably won't make it.
I was reading through your LinkedIn profile and it says that you've advised the Obamas on the future of banking. I'm just wondering if you've had a chat with Elon Musk about the future of SpaceX, maybe.
So Elon did have a chance for our team to meet with Elon briefly when I launched Augmented, the book, last year. And Elon got a signed copy of the book. So, I am working on something right now that is a project that we're trying to engage him on. I can't say much more than that right now, but it's not related to financial services, incidentally. But I'm hopeful that we can engage him. I like the way the guy thinks.
So when can we expect the book? The book's out quite soon, isn't it?
Yeah, so the book is out in June, July. It'll be probably ebook in June and then physical copy in July. I'm excited about the opportunity. I'm also working on a sequel to Augmented for next year release.
Okay.
And that's called The Rise of Techno-Socialism. And it essentially looks at how technology is going to change the way government policy works in respect to employment, things like universal basic income and so forth.
Oh, that's great. Well, I look forward to that as well. Well, Brett, it's been fascinating speaking to you, and love to get you back on again when once you've signed that deal with Elon.
Yeah, absolutely. Look
forward to it. Okay, thank you, Brett.
Welcome.
For updates on the latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel.